This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses housing affordability in Utah and how it relates to water usage, air pollution, and intergenerational wealth. According to the National Association of Realtors, U.S. housing prices fell by 0.2% from February 2022 to February 2023. Although average home prices also fell in Utah in that time, the statewide median sales price of a home actually rose in the first 2 months of 2023, jumping from $455,000 to $464,000. High prices and rising interest rates are both squeezing Utah homebuyers and have raised questions of whether they will ever be able to afford a home. Today's panel digs into these trends and looks at how increased demand is putting a strain on Utah homebuyers. The panel includes Dayon Eskich, Senior Research Fellow and Scholar at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Gabriel Lozada, Associate Professor in the Economics Department at the University of Utah. Jason Seaton, Member of the Poplar Grove Community Council. And Jake Wood, Partner and Director of Affordable Housing at J. Fisher Companies. This panel is moderated by Katie McKellar, Reporter for the Deseret News. This forum was co-sponsored by the University of Utah's Department of Economics. This forum was recorded on February 2nd, 2023. Here's your moderator, Katie McKellar.
So let's start with our panelists. Can you each give us your opening statement? Dan, let's start with you.
I was afraid you were going to start with me. Hi, my name is Dayon Eskich. I'm a senior research fellow at the University of Utah's Gardner Policy Institute. Been there for just a few days over 5 years now. And my experience with housing has always been personal. You know, when you look at this generation, you know, I'll put myself into the millennial generation, into the geriatric millennial generation. I think you're starting to see some optimism there that we are getting to home buying. When you look at the upcoming generation, it does look very challenging. And part of that is just plain and simple affordability. And how do you get into a home? So if we looked at just, this was through January when interest rates softened a little bit. So as of January, only 12% of renters could afford to buy a median priced home in Utah, which is staggering. But even if we go back before COVID, that percentage was not that much bigger. So it was only about 23%. So it's gotten worse. But if you go back before COVID, only 23% of renters could afford a median price. So the importance of it is for wealth building. We're a nation of homeowners who build wealth around our home ownership. So if we don't figure this out, I think those that are dependent on support that are going to retire from a younger generation, they're going to be in trouble a little bit too as well. So it's everybody's problem. It's not just the younger generation's problem.
Thank you. Let's pop over to Gabriel.
So I wanted to talk mostly about the problem of water in Utah, and is that going to form a constraint to growth of Utah's urban areas? My position is that if this is handled correctly, then the answer is no, it's not going to pose a constraint to growth. 82% of the water that's used in, that's diverted, I'll just say used in water, in Utah is used for agriculture. Only 4.5% is used for indoor residential uses and about 8% for outdoor residential. So Utah's water problem is overwhelmingly an agricultural problem. In terms of what about population growth, look at the state of Arizona. Compare its population in 1957 to its population now. Arizona's population has grown by a factor of 7. Arizona's population is 7 times more now than it was in 1957. Guess what's happened to Arizona's consumption of water since 1957? It's gone down, not down per capita, down in the aggregate. So urban dwellers are not really the main issue when it comes to water in the West, it's agriculture. 68% of Utah's water, according to my calculations, is used to grow hay, of which about 19% is exported to China and 10% exported to other countries. To put that in some perspective, more Utah water is used to grow hay that gets exported to foreign countries than is used in every single Utah city. And how important is the hay? It's not 2% of Utah's GDP, it's 0.2% of Utah's GDP. So what does that mean in terms of policy scenarios? We could pay farmers to stop growing hay, increase Utah's population sixfold. In other words, multiply it by a factor of six. So what, 18 million people? How much would that cost to subsidize the farmers for not growing hay? With that larger population, it would cost each Utahn about $12 a year. What about, it's another policy scenario. What if we don't think about increasing the population of Utah, but just want to increase the water flow to the Colorado River and the Great Salt Lake? We could free up three times more than the amount of water that's used in all of Utah's cities, paying about $80 per year. Now that's to the farmers. You also have to include non-farmers who would get hurt when agricultural production goes down. And so it would actually be more than $80 per year. It's hard to figure out exactly how much more, but that's the kind of scope that we're thinking about. Two other quick mentions. There's a difference between xeriscaping and zeroscaping. Many people, in fact, if you walk around the University of Utah, you see areas that are landscaped just with rocks and just a few trees. That's not Utah's natural landscape. So it's kind of hard to know what Utah's natural landscape was. By Utah, I mean northern Utah, the Salt Lake Valley. Here's a quote from a biology professor at the University of Utah from 1947. He interviewed the last male pioneer of Tooele, who related that on that person's arrival in Tooele, so mid-19th century, as a boy, he remembered a valley full of high waving grass, a veritable herder's paradise. It was not an uncommon happening for stockmen to be unable to find their animals from being lost in this high grass, which spread all over the valley. So even without any kind of irrigation, in northern Utah, the natural landscape is a grassland. It doesn't look like Phoenix. And finally, in terms of city design, what does an environmentally friendly city look like? Apparently, lots of environmentalists still think that an environmentally friendly city looks like low density, urban sprawl, lots of trees, lots of people living in single family homes with big yards. But no, what that does is it spreads the population out, increases commute time, and has a huge detrimental effect on the use of fossil fuels for transportation. An environmentally friendly city doesn't look like a natural park. An environmentally friendly city looks like a really dense area where you have lots of people living in a small space.
Great. Thank you, Gabriel. Love those visuals too. It's close to home. Tooele County out here is my home. Okay, let's go over to Jason.
Oh, my name is Jason Seaton, and I live in the Poplar Grove neighborhood. A lot of people don't know where that is. That is just west of I-15 is where it starts, and it's between about 9th South. It's a little about 9th South and goes up to North Temple, and it's a strip of land that goes all the way out towards the lake. And that is the Poplar Grove neighborhood in Salt Lake City. So it's north of Glendale and south of Fair Park. And I have been on the community council here for probably 6, 7, maybe 8 years now, and have watched a lot of change and recognize the difference between what is proposed to happen and what does happen. And, you know, witnessing that and just paying attention to that across the valley, across the city, has been pretty eye-opening. So
great. Yeah. All right. And Jake.
Thanks. My name is Jake Wood. Like Ella mentioned, I'm a partner at a local development company, Jay Fisher Companies. I oversee all of our affordable housing development. We've done about 2,000 or so units of affordable housing here in Utah and Southern Idaho, or those are our project areas. We work on everything from very low income all the way up through workforce housing, and we can talk more about that later. We do single family homes, we do multifamily. Gabriel touched on some interesting topics that I hope we can get into around sustainability, density. We do a lot of public-private partnerships, so we work with cities directly to help solve very specific housing needs in different municipalities around the Wasatch Front and the Wasatch Back. You know, some of the things that are very interesting to us, we look at, you know, housing as an individual use and the impacts there. Dayan mentioned that it is a great tool for building wealth at the individual level. We also look at from a little bit of a zoomed out economic development aspect. So that's something that we really try to measure and get into the details of that as well. You know, hopefully maybe we can get into a little bit of the public policy side. I know we have some experts on that, and that should be an interesting topic as well. When we talk about density, we talk about land use, we talk about water use, sustainability, environmental issues. Those things are all great concern to us as well. And I'm not going to get into a ton of statistics because I know Dayan is going to be the expert for that. So hopefully we can get going and have a really robust conversation. This is an amazing panel and glad to be a part of it.
Great. Thank you. Dayan, you already kind of gave us a little briefing on the state of the housing market these days and how it's impacting housing affordability. But can you expand a little bit on what the future of affordable housing specifically looks like in Utah these days?
Yeah. We find ourselves in an interesting environment where we're seeing housing demand be squeezed out by federal monetary policy, but we're not seeing the type of drop in housing prices you would typically expect when you see that type of slowdown, right? So even with that, you know, the interest rates keep rising. So, you know, we've had basically a week of just meme stock level rises in interest rates. And so just that swing prices out a good chunk of the population. So if we're talking about how do we get into home ownership, affordable home ownership, the interest rate is probably one of the most important parts to that because it determines your monthly payment. You know, we've all bought a used car and we've all haggled on a used car. And, you know, typically they'll come back, say, just tell me what you want your monthly payment to be and we'll figure it out, right? And that's kind of what we're seeing with affordability right now too on the homeownership side is, you know, home builders that have a little bit of excess inventory, they're having a hard time getting through it. So they're incentivizing by buying down the interest rates, helping would-be buyers get that monthly payment locked into a certain price. Now, that's all great if you can get into a home, but if you are stuck renting, you're at the mercy basically of the market, of the landlord. And, you know, I wouldn't paint a broad brush. I think most landlords are responsible people. They want their tenants to make their rent payments, right? So we're seeing new asking rents slow down in our market a little bit. You know, we just like with housing prices, we peaked last year and we peaked on rent. So we're seeing rents come down now. On the affordability side, specifically of affordable housing, you know, we've built more affordable housing and Jake probably built half of it. He knows this stat better than I do, but we've built more in the last couple of years than we have in the last 50 years, right? Why is that happening? Because there's such a big demand for it. And I think there's going to continue to be demand for it because of where the path to home ownership is. More people are stuck renting and incomes aren't keeping up either. So if we look at just, for example, in Salt Lake County, between the last 5 years, so rents have increased, you know, about 37% in the last 5 years. Incomes for renters have only increased about 18%. So you have these huge disparities, you know, in the cost burdening of the renter. So we continue to see more and more households pay more than 30% of their rent or their income go to rent. So I think it's going to get that trend. I don't see it getting much better, at least for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. Gabriel, kind of keeping that in mind, like these housing pressures, we've all heard about Utah's housing shortage, how it's one of the fastest growing states in the nation, and all thanks to its great economy. Can you talk to us about how that economy impacts its growth and housing issues, and how do we need to balance the need for new development with also the need to, you know, focus on sustainability and reduce water consumption, the things you mentioned in your opening statement?
So again, I don't think that, I think good water policy overwhelmingly solves the water problem in agricultural areas. So I don't think that water can be a constraint to growth if you have bad government policy. But if you have good government policy, water shouldn't be a constraint to growth. I think that the increase in Utah's population is due a lot to in-migration because, as you said, of economic growth. So the main question of affordability is the question of the housing supply. Housing supply in the United States overall, including in Utah, was hurt very much by the financial crisis in 2008. That was a financial bubble that was caused by the real estate market. And it meant that between 2008 and 2012, 2014, there was very little construction going on. And we haven't caught up with that yet. So that's one of the biggest reasons why we have a lack of supply. Proper government policy will increase the supply. An example of improper government policy is the kind of policies you have in places like California, in New York City, even in the Research Triangle area of North Carolina, where people do buy into this idea I criticized in my opening statement that if you want to be environmentally friendly, you should have low density. That's really bad government policy. It causes people to have to commute huge distances, which is really hard on them and uses a lot of fossil fuels. I don't think Utah has that problem. I think that there's an understanding that multifamily housing isn't necessarily a bad thing. And that's going to help a lot. One thing I wanted to mention, one of the panelists talked about housing as a method of building wealth for individuals. Yes, it does, but that's a bad thing. Because the reason why housing builds wealth for individuals is because house prices have been going up relative to other things. So a better situation is if being a homeowner didn't build wealth, didn't hurt wealth either, but everybody stayed neutral. That would be a signal of a situation where houses were a lot more affordable. So I just wanted to mention that.
Perfect. And you also mentioned a lot about, hey, I mean, sounds like that's where the focus really needs to be. Do you think, enough is being done to focus on that type of water conservation? Or are there any policy suggestions you'd have for the legislature?
So the lots of the discussion has been around Utah's bad government water policies in urban areas. And it's absolutely correct that Utah has horrible water pricing policies compared to the neighboring states. We subsidize our urban water districts with property taxes, which is nuts because it makes the price of water artificially low, which gives exactly the wrong kind of price signals. But as I said, the bigger question is agriculture. And Utah is actually a very urban state. Most Utahns really don't know what goes on in agriculture. So it's been almost completely ignored. The number of people who, the reason why I did the research that I did is because, I actually had to derive lots of these statistics because even the government doesn't keep them. So when you talk to people about water and agriculture, you get people saying things like, well, we can't hurt the farmers because then where will we get food? But only 1.5% of the United States hay is grown in Utah. So that's we don't get our food from Utah. Utahns get our food from other places. So there's a both, I think, on the right and on the left wing of the political spectrum, there's a huge interest in protecting farming, protecting agriculture, and not wanting to talk about the elephant in the room, which is that Utah's use of water in agriculture is unsustainable because of climate change.
That was Gabriel Lozada, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel of experts discuss housing affordability, an attempt to answer the question of many Utahns, will I ever be able to afford a home? Here again is your moderator, Katie McKellar.
Let's pop over to Jason. Can you talk to us about what your area, Poplar Grove, is facing when it comes to housing? Do your neighbors worry at all about the drought, the shrinking Great Salt Lake, air pollution, and how that impacts their housing situations now or in the future?
Sorry about that. A lot of people in the neighborhood are very aware of what's happening around us. We definitely stand apart from the rest of the city. We're kind of a forgotten area by the city. It's kind of unfortunate. But when it comes to being aware of drought situation, you know, everyone here doesn't really have a yard. They have space, they have acreage, but they don't have grass. No one here is spending money on yards. And the few that do, over the last year, and probably including the year before, the two summers were pretty hot. They let their yards die, just let them die. And the economic differences here compared to the rest of the city are pretty big. But that doesn't mean that people aren't aware of what's going on around them. And I think a lot of people are pretty proactive about doing things. And it is interesting to see that happen, because you know, if I go for a stroll on the east side of town, there's some pretty nice yards hanging out over there. It's like they can have a yard, but we can't. It's kind of the feeling sometimes. But at the same time, it's a lot cheaper to just not have a yard. And in there's a lot more poverty here. And in that situation, it's just one less thing to worry about. So it's easy. It's easy to not use water because it saves money.
And are your neighbors also struggling with the housing situation and affordability and people who might want to move into your neighborhood, stuff like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I think a lot of houses tripled in value during the pandemic. I think it's artificial. I think for everyone, citywide, statewide, I think a lot of it is ballooned, and then it'll come down to something a little more normal. But folks here, there's a little bit of sticker shock with taxes shooting up quite a bit. I mean, triple the price or value, you triple your tax, right? Almost. So that's a little bit, but the thing that our neighborhood is probably the way that it is that it has traditionally been more rental because it's an old neighborhood. And so you in Glendale, just south of us, that's a post-World War II era neighborhood, right? That's a lot of buildings, a lot of brick houses that were built post-war. And then this neighborhood, Glendale, is 100 years old, a little more than. And generationally speaking, people have lived here for a long time. And then when they pass away or their kids move away, they end up with their parents' homes, and then they just rent them. And that's a lot of the way this neighborhood is this generational rental situation, where the vast majority of homes here have been rented until just before the pandemic, where maybe some of those generational folks they don't want to deal with rentals anymore, and they're willing to sell the house. And there has been a little bit of turnover in that scenario. But yeah, this is a heavily rented neighborhood.
Yeah. Gee, can you talk to us about what hurdles stand in the way of affordable housing these days and what you think needs to be done about those hurdles?
I'll try. So
yeah, that's the age old question, isn't it?
Yeah, we talk about this all the time, and really you know, Gabriel made an interesting point when he said that, you know, home ownership and property ownership is a great way currently in our society for individuals to build wealth. And that maybe that's not such a good thing. I think it is a good thing, but I do think that it's outsized, and I think that it is disproportionate and unbalanced. And what it does is it really just creates that sort of barbell structure where, you know, you really get cleaved into the haves and the have nots when it comes to property ownership. So I agree with him that that's a bad thing. You know, I like to interact with folks who are in the academic realm because I try to bring a little bit of the voice of the practical side of things rather than the academic side of things. So I like to think about things as we wish that they would be. And then I also like to act on things as they are and in our current condition. So with that caveat, maybe I could talk a little bit about how we actually try to implement affordable housing strategies and build new product, because we all talked about supply versus demand. The demand for housing at every level is unfulfilled in Utah and specifically in our urban markets right now. All the way up and down the spectrum, there is a need for more housing. And so I'm a housing bull at every level. I think we need more low-income affordable. I think we need more moderate income. I think we need more multifamily, single family, the missing middle. I think we need more of all of it. And so I think anyone who's studied this understands how the pressure gets eased as more housing comes in at every level. Everyone who's been downtown, you know, you've noticed that 5 years ago, we had zero for rent high rise product in Salt Lake City. Now we have thousands of units either recently completed or under construction right now. And that's a function of the high end expanding in our market. So when we as real estate developers make decisions about whether or not to build any type of product, we look at the economics and we understand that we have to have the demand on the back end, but we also have to be able to finance. We have to understand the economics of the, you know, the deal. And so the reason those high rises are being built now is because they are supportable by the rents that they're achieving. You know, we see rents at $3-$4 a square foot for a rental unit that didn't used to exist in this market, but it does now. So what's happened is the cost to the end consumer has blown out, and the wages haven't kept up. Other, you know, the economic factors in our market haven't kept up with that. So it's really caused us as developers of low to moderate income housing to be squeezed out of that development market. So mm-hmm. Where I'm going with this is when we go to buy a piece of land, we're competing with a high-end market rate developer. When we hire a general contractor or a subcontractor, we're competing with a developer of a high-end, you know, market rate unit. So for us, the challenges are just magnified because our whole goal is to keep the rent low, to keep the cost of purchase low, to keep the cost of the end user low, and it just creates a wider gap. So for us, it comes down to finance. And then Dayan mentioned interest rates. That's the driver of the whole economy here. So as those rates go up, hopefully to Jason's point, maybe there is a cooling effect on overall housing price. Maybe that does flatten the curve there, but it also makes it way more difficult to bring new supply into the market. So the supply-demand imbalance also only gets worse as the interest rates rise. So it's a little bit of doom and gloom there on yeah. bringing new supply into the market. The good news though is I think that this is actually on the radar now. You know, Gabriel mentioned issues that affect both the left and right of the political spectrum. I think this is truly one of those issues. We see a lot of coming together, the state level, all the way down to counties, cities, towns. Everyone understands this is an issue, and it's become a matter of policy to help close those economic gaps. And so if I had a little bit of a silver lining or good news, I would say I think that is it. You know, the public sector stepping in to help solve some of those issues.
Great point. Yeah, there are a lot of factors at play here, and I'll kind of open it up to the panel. But, you know, the question here is, what policies have we enacted or should we enact to address the problem with housing affordability? Dan, specifically, I know Jake kind of touched on this too, but can you speak to which types of development we ought to be prioritizing? Single family, multifamily, homeless shelters? That's what the student group is wondering. And, you know, is there a larger policy discussion too to be had?
All of the above would mm-hmm. be my answer. You know, Jake just mentioned there's demand for every single price point, and that's very true. You know, and you see that especially in the last 2 years, the homes that sold close to $1 million, you would have never in your life thought that they would be $1 million. And it's not that we have this credit bubble that's overhyping it, is there were buyers, right? And part of our issue too is, you know, we have a lot of local policy discussions and hurdles we need to get at, because when I think about the price of a housing, when it's set, the most important date for a housing price is the day the land is entitled, because that puts you on a certain level, and the developer is going to price that home at a certain point based on what they paid for the land, right? So if you can densify and squeeze more units in there, you're going to get more, you're going to get cheaper housing than otherwise you would. I hear this from home builders all the time when they're trying to rezone. And, you know, if they have, say, a couple hundred acres, you know, they're pricing their homes in the mid 500s. Well, the city now says, well, we don't like your density. We need you to do bigger plots so they can build less houses on that land. So the price of homes go up. So they're still hitting their bottom lines, right? They're just building less houses. So they're spreading that land cost over to less people. So the houses cost more. So in some of those particular cases, you see the price of a home go from 500s into the 600s, you know, and sometimes it could even go more. So it really depends on local policy. I think that is the biggest hurdle to building more supply, right? It is to figure out a comfortable way for the local politics to play out. And the state has a role to play. I think, you know, there's a proposal right now from Senate President Adams about setting aside $50 million that can be used for down payments, $20,000 per applicant. And what I think is unique, what they did there, my first glance was, oh, they're just going to incentivize demand and they're just going to blow it up. But what they did in there was add a stipulation that it has to be new construction under $450,000 to help mm-hmm. incentivize the supply as well. So I think, you know, when you have a proposal like that in a red state, like from the Senate president, I think it speaks volumes to just what a obstacle this is for our state, that you're seeing, you know, political ideology be damned, we have to like throw some fire in here to get the market to unlock. So
yeah, Jason's chomping at the bit.
Yeah, I'm gonna be a little cynical about that. When you have a bunch of developers on the hill who build things, that's incentivizing that, but they don't need that. I think, you know, everyone wants this stuff. I don't think you need to incentivize building things. We're doing that. We're doing it at a record pace still, and it's not enough, but it will be at some point. Things are going to change, and then suddenly it'll slow down, and you can build yourself into a hole. Or you know, in the last 2 years, we've seen people were racing to get a house, and they felt like they were going to get left out, like there was never going to be a house again available ever. And so they figured out they were willing to pay exceedingly more than maybe a house was worth. And what's going to happen in that situation is suddenly they're going to get jobs somewhere else, some other city or something. And they're going to have to wait for that house value and the rest of the market to kind of come together, because they paid way up here and the house isn't really worth that because the values are kind of coming down, or house prices are coming down. And so it's not such a hot market, and they're going to be stuck. And that itself is going to create a little cooling on its own, because no one's going to buy my house so fast, and I need to leave town to take the job that's going to pay me more money or whatever. And I just think there's a lot of things at play over the last few years that are out of whack. And when they start to filter down, it'll be forced to cool. And so the prices will come down, and so will interest rates a little bit, but we still have decent interest rates. I mean, when my parents wanted to buy a house in the 80s, you know, it was like 13%, you know, but the difference was a house only cost $40,000.
Right.
So there again is the difference. We're just at the other side of that. Houses are really expensive and interest rates have been artificially low. So I think there's a lot at work. And when people are afraid that they're never going to get a house, I think, yes, it's a little bit of a strain right now, but I don't think it's forever. I think markets go up and down. And 10 years ago, they were considering demolishing homes because there was too many. You know, the Federal Reserve was talking about, how do we get rid of all these empty homes? Well, we should just bulldoze them to create value in the ones that we still want. That's completely crazy. But it was on the table.
Dan, a rebuttal?
Yeah, I think those are some great points. And I share some of Jason's concern about those that have bought a home in the last year and if they have to move suddenly. But we have to acknowledge that 80% of, or 78% of mortgages in Utah have an interest rate under 4%. We because of the Dodd-Frank and everything we learned from the financial crisis, how we underwrite mortgages is super boring and not very exciting. We're very conservative. So a figure, for example, in 2021, 2022, roughly 65 to 70% of mortgage origination went to people who had a 760 credit score or higher. Okay. In 2005, 2004, leading up to the great financial crisis, it was only 25%. So we vetted, we stopped giving out loans. And that's how we got into trouble last time, is because, you know, the four or five of us on this panel, we could get 20 mortgages. You know, we just need to apply for them. So that in itself created artificial demand. We don't have that credit bubble that we had back then. When we underwrite somebody in today's mortgage market, we make damn sure that they can pay the mortgage back on a monthly basis, that they have proof of income. So that's made credit availability. If you look at a lot of, you know, mortgage indices right now, the credit availability is super tight, right? So you go to apply today, if you want a better interest rate, you have to, you know, pay tens of thousands of dollars for it, right? So we're not giving mortgages to people who cannot afford to cover them. So in that sense, I think the typical ownership household is positioned in a much better environment to take on some sort of hit. And, you know, everybody who's had their home for more than 2 to 3 years, they've got plenty of equity to absorb that shock, right? If we were to experience some sort of major dip. So, you know, if you bought your house in the last year, you're kind of on the fence. But that represents such a small number of transactions that it would not make a major dent in the market overall. It might in some metro areas, right, specifically, but overall, I think in our market, we would not see major disruptions, in my opinion.
I want to leave time for audience questions, but I did also kind of want to get to the heart of this panel right before we take questions, and this kind of came into my mind, was there was a quote up on the Hill recently that, quote, "the starter home is extinct." Do you guys agree with that statement? And do you think this generation of students will actually be able to afford a home along the Wasatch Front when it comes time for them to buy? Jake?
Well, I would say I've for a long time really fought against the concept of the starter home just as a broad concept. I don't think that it's a healthy way to think about you know, how we view real estate, how we view housing. You know, that kind of puts it into the context of a purely a transactional type of thing. Whereas really what we talk about is housing sort of more fundamentally than that. You know, it's like it's one of the first components of the pyramid when you're talking about, you know, building your hierarchy is having safe, secure, and predictable housing. That has nothing to do with long-term investments. That has nothing to do with climbing the property ladder. It has nothing to do with any of that. So I think that concept is a little bit flawed in general. As for whether or not, you know, the next generation is going to be able to afford to buy into the market, I think that I'm pretty optimistic about that in general, because I do think, you know, and Jason said this multiple times, our market isn't linear pointed straight up. I mean, it moves a lot. It kind of comes in and out. It's cyclical. And so when we look at the opportunities, there will be plenty of them as they come about. There's also, the concept of expectation. When you talk about your first home, a lot of us, I bought my first house when I was 28 years old. And so, you know, in Utah, that sounds old and ancient, but in a lot of other parts of the country, that's really the time when household formations really start to occur. And I know Dan studied that statistic a lot. So I think in Utah, we get a little bit of a different perspective about what the expectation should be. I think nationally, if you look at statistics, the number of 22 to 25 year olds that are buying into the real estate market is going to be incredibly low. So, you know, I also look at this from a rental perspective as well. We do single family homes, but we also do a lot of multifamily. And anecdotally, talking to the people that use the multifamily housing, they have a little bit of a different profile, but they still fit into that same need of that same type of housing. So I don't want to forget about them in this whole conversation because I don't have the statistic off the top of my head. I'm sure Dan will tell me later that I'm wrong, but I think it's somewhere between 30 and 40%. Are renters in our market right now. I'm sure he can correct me on that later. But anyway, that's just my two cents. I want to hear what everyone else has to say.
Go ahead, Jason.
I'd like to say that there are another factor. I didn't get I rented for a long, long time. I didn't know where I wanted to be. I didn't see a house as a bank. I saw it as a place to, you know, set roots. That's just me. You know, I grew up as a kid traveling around the country because my dad was in the Navy. And so I was a little more nomadic and it didn't really matter. Now older, I think, oh, well, there's a lot of money involved. It's kind of a house is kind of a bank. It's where if you decide to sell it, you kind of get your money back that you put into it. Even if the value has gone up, then you get your interest back too that you've been paying to the bank. But I think there are other factors out in our nation as a whole and around here. And if you get the postcards in the mail, if you own a home, you'll get a postcard in the mail all the time, weekly, maybe even daily. It says, we'll buy your house for cash. Do you want to sell your house? And I think corporations snatching up homes and renting them out is a factor that's not really being included in what we traditionally think of as home buying, or it doesn't, whether it's a single family home or apartments or whatever. I think we see it as I go to school, I earn some money, I buy a house. And that does feel very linear and natural, but when you have a corporation going in and snatching up homes from people saying, I'll pay you cash today, I'll pay you more, then it makes it really hard for someone. It keeps homes off the market. And that also drives up that race to buy something or difficulty in buying something. Mm-hmm. And I think that one day we'll have to broach that because corporations owning hundreds of thousands of homes in this country just to rent them out, you know, it's capitalism at its best, probably, but it's probably an unforeseen consequence of marketplaces. And I think that's going to have, moving forward, a large effect on owning a house.
Dan and Gabriel, you want to jump in on that discussion before we go to questions?
I certainly think that if you start getting sort of monopoly power, oligopoly ownership of homes, that would be a really bad thing. Otherwise, corporations buying houses and then renting them does make it harder to buy a house, but makes it easier to rent. Other things being equal, it lowers rents, and so it's easier to save up to buy a house. So I'm not sure in the long run which way that goes. I think that the opportunity that corporations had is in the great financial crisis between 2008 and let's say 2014, 2015, lots of corporations could still borrow money and could still finance purchases, whereas lots of homeowners couldn't. And so there was, you might want to call it an artificial lack of demand from individuals because they couldn't get finance, but the corporation still could get finance. So that's probably the reason why this has happened.
That was Gabriel Lozada, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience.
I'm so grateful for this discussion, and it's just a joy to hear, you know, from these experts. I want to throw in a topic that sort of is an undercurrent but hasn't been emphasized, and that's about political conflict. So about the water issue, right? So we're currently considering to apply eminent domain to expand the width of I-15. So we're going to kick people out of their houses in order to expand the highway and use fossil fuels to commute to work and living spaces. We're not considering to apply eminent domain to farmers' water rights, right? The logic that Gabriel outlines is that there's plenty of water. The problem is that we don't have control over the water because nobody can touch the political power of farmers, as has been emphasized. The issue that I see that Jason and Jake and also Dan sort of have touched upon is similar between Poplar Grove and Glendale and other areas and the East Benches. You know, we're seeing lots of density in certain parts of town. We're not seeing them east of 13th. And so there is an element of political conflict there, where and how we reach higher levels of density. And I'm just curious how anybody on the panel considers these issues to be relevant.
Anyone want to jump to tackle that?
So one thing just to say about water, if the state offered to buy water from farmers, then you're still respecting, for better or for worse, you're still respecting the water rights that the original pioneers were granted by the government in the mid-19th century. So one way of solving the water problem is for urban residents to pay farmers not to farm. And if you pay them enough, they'll take you up on that offer because they make more money doing that than farming. So that's one way of overcoming political opposition. You overcome it by offering people money. In terms of local conflict, the United States has, this is probably a bad thing. I was going to say for better or for worse, but it's probably for worse, has extremely localized control over land use. If land use were regulated at the state or even at the federal level, conversations would be quite different. But right now, it's so hyper-localized that indeed, people who live east of 13th East in Salt Lake City can have one kind of land use because of their political pressure. And people who live in Poplar Grove have a totally different kind of land use because they lack political power. One of the difficulties is the structure of U.S. governance in terms of land use.
I'm not seeing any hands raised, but I can follow up on that. I do notice this year that the legislature is focused on more of a free market approach when it comes to helping the housing market and land use decisions. There's even a bill to, you know, make certain land use decisions immune to referendums if they get a two-thirds majority vote. Do you kind of agree with that approach? Is there too much local control here? Or I know the local control debate at the legislature is always fun, but thoughts on that, Gabriel or Jason?
Yeah, so I personally agree with that, this is an acronym NIMBY, not in my backyard. Everybody agrees that we need more housing, but not in my backyard, not anywhere close to where I live, because it's going to hurt my property values. That's not good for the general society. Where you see that most, as I said, as maybe ironically, in blue states like California, like New York, where you have extremely restrictive land use that has made, it's made the price of housing really high, but we're not really talking about the price of housing. We're talking about the price of land. And the price of land in the San Francisco Bay Area and the Los Angeles Bay Area and New York City, there's no reason why it has to be that high. It's just because of restrictive land use policies.
Okay, I really want to get to some listener questions. So let's go to William Hardig, if I'm saying that right.
Yes, thank you very much. I do have a question here with the talk of eminent domain and political pressures and development and all that. And who is ultimately responsible for developing affordable housing? Is that the state government, the municipal government, neighborhoods? Like, who does that fall to, I guess?
Anyone want to tackle
that? Who should it fall to?
It's a combination because cities promote it. So there in Salt Lake City, there is tax incentives. There have been tax incentives that that I think for 10 years, that the developer wouldn't have to pay certain taxes on that development to promote its being put there. And so now the question is what is affordable in that? Some of those are just to bring the masses into the city. And some of that is to make sure that some of those apartments are affordable. So they have zoning to say, hey, you know, you're going to put so many units on this spot, but we want a percentage of those to be below market rate to allow for folks who couldn't normally afford this place to be able to move in there. The irony to that is, depending on if I build the same building on this side of town or that side of town in Salt Lake City, the one on the west side will have 80% below market, and the one on the east side of town will be 10%. Maybe less. So there's those political pressures are at play in that scenario. Same building, just a few blocks away from each other, different outcome. And it, from a more political point of view, it's what it starts to do is it starts to corral all the poor people together, right? Because this is what I can afford. So this is where I'm going to be. And instead of distributing wealth, and that's a bad term, but instead of distributing, you know, people throughout the city of all different, you know, heights and sizes, you really corral different groups of people. So, and it's a natural occurrence. It's always been that way. You know, the east side is definitely a little more well off, but and I can understand why they don't want those developments. And those are nice neighborhoods. But in my neighborhood, you know, we have 50 acres owned by Salt Lake City, and I can't get any developer to look at it to say, hey, we need a mixed use development out here that allows us to have grocery stores. We're cut off from all that stuff. So if you're going to put more housing somewhere, you have to support all those people with other things. And, we don't have any of that. That's something we're cut off. We're cut off on four sides by interstate and by railroad. It's very difficult to move in and out of town. It's easy to leave town. It's easy to get to the airport. It's easy to get on the freeway, but I can't drive east very easily without getting stopped by a train or having to find a bridge or something when a train is 2 miles long. So there's these other things that have stopped development west of I-15, where there might be more room because of crazy notions that, well, it's not valuable out there. We don't see any value in that. And it's here, but we can't have that stuff. It's really bizarre. So
yeah. Anyone else want to jump in on that question before I go to the next one?
Can I just add something there? And I think that it's an important point. First of all, Jason, I'll look at that 50 acres. maybe we can figure out something there. But
I'll point it out to you.
All right, great. I think something that kind of gets lost in the shuffle sometimes, and the last question sort of spurred me to point this out. We're talking about housing, affordable housing as this broad spectrum thing, but really, I think it's important to make the distinction. We talk about affordable housing, and then we talk about housing that is affordable, right? And that's two different things. When we talk about affordable housing, most often we're talking about something that's deed restricted, it's built with a specific intent, it's restricted to who can use that housing, whether it be income based or rental based or some other factor that is actually creating a very narrow use band for that housing. And then housing that is affordable is broad spectrum, right? More of a societal shift that we're talking about is creating environments where that can thrive. And it's not necessarily us as the developer coming and putting something in and saying these 10% of units are now restricted to people who make 60% of the area median income and the rent can only be capped at $700 a month or whatever it is. But it's actually thinking about solutions and policies that help create a ecosystem, an environment where that housing that is affordable and that, naturally occurring affordable housing is something we use in the industry jargon. Typically, a lot of times that's associated with lower quality, lower socioeconomic geographic areas and other things that sort of influence that affordability. But I do agree that, a citywide solution is not off the table. There's definitely land use policies. Gabriel makes a great point. Removing local controls is a big push. I can't tell you how many times we've assessed a piece of land based on the number of parking spots that we need to provide per the code that governs that individual location. That's insane that we're doing that way. So, I definitely agree with that as well. So I just wanted to make that point.
I do want to go to our next question from Mickey Maples.
All right. So yeah, I did have a question about basically just the main idea of this, panel, which was, will I ever be able to afford housing? My idea of when I'd be able to invest into housing or when I should buy a house was going to be about like 10 to 20 years down the line when a lot of baby boomers will actually like start dying, which is, I guess, a really sad thing. But I thought maybe at that point it'd be pretty good to invest because with the lack of when supply starts to increase with the baby boomers dying, then it'd be probably a good time to actually buy a house. But is that actually a good idea? That's kind of what I wanted to ask.
Yeah. Dan? So I have a slide that says 2020s are about millennials and 2030s are about baby boomers .. dying. So, not to make, be inappropriate about it, but I think we're going to expect that, right? We're going to expect more opportunities, I guess you could call them, for home flippers, right? So I think that this is where I think when Wall Street firms look at it, the way they're positioning themselves, when you look at some of the higher net worth areas across every major metro areas, it's older generation, right? It's neglected homes that probably haven't been touched for 20, 30 years. And those people that are currently stuck, right? They can sell their home, but where do they go? And so I think the 2030s present a lot of challenges and opportunities from the housing stock perspective. But what we're going to see on the spectrum of, our market is, when we look at, if you see the population pyramid and you look at when people buy houses, typically the first time homebuyers in the U.S. is 32 years of age. Right now, what we're going through as a country is we have 32.5 million people hitting that 32 years of age between 2020 and 2025, between those years. That represents about 9.5% of the population. In Utah, we have 10.5% of the population going through that age spectrum, right? So if we look at further down the road, what we think age structure is going to look like in the 2030s, we see, Gen Z, right, they start hitting the housing market. And we have more Gen Zers right now in our market than we have of any other generation. So in our market, it's going to be continue to be competitive. But if you go to some other markets, their supply is going to, their demand is going to be much lower because their share of population is much older than ours. We're always the younger state.
Thank you. I know we're right at 1 o'clock. There's one more question in the chat. Maybe if anyone wants to take a stab at that, from Trevor Jensen saying, for anyone saying that you've been fighting against the idea of a starter home for all people is essentially incongruent to someone who makes their living as a property developer. Where does that dichotomy fit into the reality that there is not enough affordable housing while our youngest generation is expected to never own a home? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
I feel like maybe that one was directed at me. if someone thinks that I'm fighting against this concept of a starter home in my practice, in my business, then they, I think I was ineloquent in my comment because that's not what I'm doing at all. My goal and my mission in the work that we do at my company is that we want to provide those opportunities. We want to help people reach their goals and their dreams, whether that's through the opportunity to purchase a home or to have a stable rental environment that allows them to take one less worry off the page. So hopefully that is helpful. I think maybe we're, there might have been a miscommunication on the way that I feel about starter homes, perhaps.
Jason?
I'm going to interject on that a little bit because I agree with this notion of a starter home concept is ridiculous. My house is 100 years old and it's not very big, but I like old homes. But if this home was anywhere else in the valley, if it was built today, someone would probably consider it a starter home because it's small, right? And I think it's ridiculous. This, anything that was built is probably going to stand for about 100 years, probably. And it's going to swap hands a bazillion times. It's going to go from bank loan to bank loan to bank loan for 100 years, right? I mean, someone will live there for 10 years, had a 30-year mortgage, and then they'll sell it and the bank's always getting paid. And it's just another home. Does it suit you? Does it fit you? I think that's probably more important. And I think the one thing that no one's talked about here is how much money do you make? You know, that is where there's probably a huge out of balance piece of the pie. And especially in Utah, you know, we have a lot of folks coming in from other big cities that are being offered a lot of money to come here. And so they're buying these bigger homes. But the folks who've grown up here are probably in jobs that aren't paying them that unless they have managed to get into a position in one of these tech places, you know, they didn't get laid off. But the point is that, you know, we have to balance how much we make in this country and in our state with the prices of things. We are kind of underpaid for a lot of things. And that's a huge undertaking. It's so easy for us to use the term affordable. It's kind of a red herring. The cost of, you know, sheetrock and 2x4s and paint, all of these things are completely different industries, completely different groups of people making these things. And they come from different countries or they get built anywhere in our country and they're all put together in your house. And they all have variables in their price and when they come and where they come from. And it's just funny that this term affordable housing really is dictated by the cost of all those elements. And then the rest is sheer market. And that means, you know, what's trending today? Are we all racing to buy something or are we in a big recession? What is going on at any one point? And I think really the big deal is get out there, make some money, save some money if you can, and then be ready when a when a better time arrives for doing that. Right now is probably not the, you know, it's coming down, it's better, but everyone, like I said before, everyone is racing to buy something and they're willing to pay more than something was probably worth. And eventually it will even out if they stay there long enough, it's fine. But I think being prepared to buy something over time is the key.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.